Hi, I'm Richard Cutland, and welcome to a brand new podcast, Tank Nuts, where I get the chance to sit down and chat with a wide variety of people. Veterans, stuntmen, serving soldiers. In fact, a whole host of people, but all with one thing in common, a love and passion for armour. Hello and welcome to Tank Nuts. Now, today's guest, you may never have heard of his name before. However, I absolutely guarantee that you would have at least seen some of the things he's been involved with, i.e. movie-wise, or some of the series that he's been part of. Now, in front of me, a bit of a list and some of the 204 credits to his name. And these include a host of Bond films, Star Wars, Harry Potter, Saving Private Ryan, A Bridge Too Far, Where Eagles Dare, The Dirty Dozen, Top Gear, the series, one of my favourites, and more recently, Fury. So it is with great delight that I'd like to introduce today one of Britain's leading stuntmen, Mr. Jim Dowdle. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Richard. I'm fine. Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Thank you very much for coming. So that's quite a list there, Jim. We were talking earlier about 204 credits. Do you think that's about accurate, or is there a lot more involved there?
Well, as though that doesn't include commercials, I've done 280 car commercials and 340 miscellaneous commercials and live shows and jousted in America. And there's lots of stuff that doesn't go on the IMDb simply because they're not interested in, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do, or it doesn't get credited. I don't know how they put it all together, all that list, but there's a lot more there. I could bore you for hours with it.
Good heavens. And now, getting to understand Jim, now obviously for a lot of us listening to this, it's how on earth did that sort of like become a stuntman in the first place? Now obviously I've looked at a bit of your bio. When did you first get into it and your very first job? You've got to tell us about it because this is absolutely incredible.
I left school at 16 with one O-level and joined the circus. I worked for a lion trainer called Gerd Simeonet.
The way you say it though, it's like it's a normal thing to do. I left school at 16 and joined the circus.
But yeah, well, you know, it's that old thing about my mother kept on saying, you'll never get, your life will never treat you well unless you've got five O-levels and two A-levels. And I was never going to get five O-levels and two A-levels as long as, you know, I've got a hole in my arse. So at 16, I wasn't going to go on the dole because there was a real thing about being on the dole. And now everybody does it. But then there was a stigma about actually claiming the dole. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. And I thought, well, it's the beginning of the summer. Let's have a go at that. Anyway, cut a long story short, I worked for this lion trainer and I did a little bit of acrobatic because I was a gymnast at school. I was a Sussex schoolboys gymnastics champion and therefore that was what I was good at. And so, and then when the circus finished at the end of the season, then I went and did a whole series of jobs. I worked in a motorcycle company called Pride and Clark and learned how to strip down old bikes and learned about engines and all that kind of stuff. And I worked as a washing cars for a car hire company. I worked in Harrods over Christmas, packing toys. I drove a minicab. It was just fun, you know. The jobs were easy in those days. You could pick work up.
Yeah.
No problem, little bits of casual work and all that kind of stuff. And then at the end of 1 year, I got the sack from Harrods for smoking on the escalators because I was a member of staff and staff weren't allowed. Everybody else could have a cigar with a tripod on it, you know, but staff weren't allowed to smoke on the thing. And my sister was working for Purnell's History of the Second World War as a picture editor. And she knew about as much about the Second World War pictures as I do about rocket research. So I would go in there because I was very interested historically and say, this is what that is. That's that type of tank or that's that type of gun or whatever it is. And it's this campaign. And so I was helping her. And they were getting photographs from a company in London called Baptiste. And Baptiste are film suppliers who supply everything from a flick knife to an anti-tank gun. Anything, swords, guns, anything you like on the military side. And they were looking for an assistant armourer. I knew nothing practically about because I hadn't been in the military at that point. But I got the job there. And after a few weeks of learning bits and pieces, I got taken onto the set as an assistant armourer on The Dirty Dozen.
Wow. What age were you then? This is
I would have been about 19 then.
Wow.
And keen as mustard, but didn't know anything from anything. And the first day on the film, I was told to go around and show the actors, some of the actors, what weapons they would be using. So I go to Donald Sutherland's room, and he's going, oh, yeah, man. It was just like his character in Kelly's Heroes. He was a hippie in real life, really. And he said, oh, yeah, man, show me how it's done, blah, blah. Charles Bronson said, I know how to shoot guns, kid. Get the hell out of here. So, all right, that's nothing. And then I go to Lee Marvin's room. Now, Lee Marvin is, you know, quite a serious star, but I don't know anything about his history. So I'm thinking, and I get this gruff voice, and yep. So I go in, it's dressing, it's 10 o'clock in the morning, and there's Lee Marvin sitting with his feet up on the table, smoking a big cigar, and he's got a half a bottle of Jack Daniels in front of him. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I said, what do you want, kid? I said, I'm Jim, sir. I'm the assistant armourer. I come to show you the weapons you'll be using on the film. And this glint comes into his eye. I don't know what's going on. Very naive at that point. I still am. And go into the dressing room, and I've got this M3 grease gun, 45 thing. And he said, okay, kid, do your thing. So I start going through the routine with this. Like, this guy's never fired a gun before. And I'm giving the page. You have to be very careful which way you point it. And the empties come out of the right-hand side, and they're quite hot because you have to be careful. And he's going, oh, really? Okay, that's fine. And now he's sitting down, and I'm up there. So the eye line is like this. So he says, so let me take a look at that, kid. So he takes the weapon off me, and now he's engaging with me eye to eye, and he starts to strip the gun down without looking at it, right? And he puts it on the table in its four component parts, right? And then he looks down at it, and I look down at it, and then he looks up again and starts conversing, and he puts it back together again without looking at it, and then he cocks it and then hands me the magazine, and I take this and I go, right, okay. Feeling like this now, this high. And for the rest of the movie, because he was a Marine who was wounded in the Pacific, and secondly, he was decorated, and he was a gun nut. He loved guns. So him and I used to talk guns. And for a guy like myself, 19 years old, to be able to talk to Lee Marvin on a level about weapons and things was a real privilege. Wow. But he used to get seriously pissed, and by about middle of the afternoon he was pretty much gone. But he would always, like a good soldier, carry his weapon with him, and he would always say, the prop man would say, you know, do you want me to take you? No, where's Jimmy? And he would always cock the weapon, take the mag out and show it to me, and hand the gun out. However drunk he was, he never left that weapon anywhere. Whereas Bronson, at the end of the you know, when at the end of the shot, he'd literally take his gun off and he'd throw it on the ground and walk away. Yeah, he couldn't give a shit. Not a very nice man. And 20 years later, we were doing the Dirty Dozen Next Mission, which was a made-for-TV show.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
dreadful,
yeah.
Piece of junk. So now I'm a stuntman. It's 20 years on from there. And I go there to do a job to flip a motorcycle, a sidecar outfit, which we would rig by putting... we would weld a tire iron on the front of the sidecar so that it was just about an inch and a half off the surface of the road, fill the front of the sidecar up with bags of sand so that you came into where you want it to happen, you yank the handlebars, the weight would push the sidecar nose down, the tire iron would dig into the ground, and that would flip the bike over the sidecar. So I've gone there to do this job. So I'm dressed in a German, you know, one of those long motorcycle coats. I've got a helmet. It's winter, it's cold. I'm on the dining bus, just going, and I can feel somebody's looking at me. And I look at the end of the dining bus, and there's Lee Marvin right down the end. And he looks at me, and he does that whole deal with cocking the weapon, taking it and handing it to me, and then points at me, and he goes, it's you, isn't it? And I thought, you know, that was one of the great moments that he should have remembered me from, you know, because they, you know, these are big, serious stars.
Oh, absolutely.
20 years later, yeah. It was just a wonderful moment. Anyway, sorry, that was a long way of saying... So the Dirty Dozen was one of the was the first one, and then after that, we went out to Austria for 4 months to do Where Eagles Dare, with you know, Clint Eastwood,
classic
and,
movie.
Yes, and Richard Burton, and we had an amazing time out there. And I mean, that was a real, it was just an extraordinary experience. I mean, really extraordinary experience. And of course, Clint Eastwood had just done the Dollar film, so he was climbing up the ladder very seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
But Richard Burton was, again, this huge, huge megastar married to Elizabeth Taylor. And he, again, was very severely into the bottom of the bottle by about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And we'd done a shot in Austria, which had been, we'd had a whiteout, there'd been a blizzard, and we couldn't get it So I had to reproduce this in the studio. So we had a telegraph pole halfway up a slope with supposed to be snow on it, which is actually just salt. And they just wanted one line of dialogue. And we were trying to get Clint Eastwood finished because he had to get back. We were way overdue, and I think his wife was going to have the first child. So we were working till 9 or 10 o'clock at night, by which time Burton was pissed as a rat. And so the cameras are down the bottom of this slope, and I'm up the top to hand them the guns as they go onto the set, and then as they come off, I take the guns off them. And Burton has got one line. Cut. Again, Richard. Anyway, this is going, we've done like 11 takes like this, and everybody wants to just go home, right? And now Elizabeth Taylor has appeared, because she used to come and pick him up on the set. So she's behind the camera, and you could tell when she came on the set, it was an amazing presence that lady had. And eventually he says from the top, he says, Elizabeth, are you there? And this little disconnected voice comes from behind the camera. Yes, Richard. Elizabeth, I don't seem to be able to get this line. What do you suggest I do? And this voice from behind the camera said, why don't you try acting, you big CU, if you know how, and then we could all get the F out of here and go home. And he said, oh. The next time he did it, he was word perfect. It was absolutely extraordinary. We got the tape. Thank you very much. Check the gate. Go home.
Power of the wife, you see.
I mean, she was an extraordinary presence. You know, he just bought her that ring, which was $1 million, to marry her, I think, for the second or the third. I got lost count, you know. And she was great. She came in the next, because it was on the front page of all the papers. And she came in the next day with this ring on and, you know, this big glaring diamond. She said, yeah, look, here it is and everything else. And one of the chippies got a saw out and he started chasing it around the stage and said, let's see if it's real or it's glass, you know. And she played the game, ran around the stage and do all that kind of stuff. Very different times.
And you were still an armourer at this stage.
Yes.
So how did you make the transition then from doing the armourer to just suddenly wake up one day and thought, do you know what?
Do you know, I thought I could be doing this in 40 years' time. I don't want to be an armourer in 40 years' time. Yeah. And after 3 years of having this extraordinary time, I thought it was time to move on. So I left and I drove a cab for a bit. And then I thought, I think I'll join the army because my dad was at Arnhem and he always went on about Arnhem and paratroopers and all that. And I thought, okay. So I went and joined up and I did P Company and I got in and it was at a time in 1970 when there was, you know, the British Army was being cut to ribbons financially and it was a Labour government and there was very few aircraft allocations and the only service you either saw was in Northern Ireland, which is a horrible posting anyway because it was after Warren Point and I was in One Para and it was after our boys had been blown up there. Or you went to Germany. Either way, it was not an exciting time. But we did a night exercise. And I hurt my back. I impacted two vertebrae in the base of my spine. And they said, that's it for you. No more jumping. So you lose your bounty. You don't get any, you know, get extra money for jumping. And they said, well, you know, we'll send you on a driver's course. And you can learn to drive a truck. And I went, yeah, can't wait, you know.
Should become a tank.
And the CO, no, but the CO, bless his heart to this day, said, I don't think this is a bit of you, is it? And I said, I'm not really so. And he said, I think we'll give you a medical discharge. And to this day, I worship that man. And so I left with a medical discharge after about 19, 20, 21 months. Having learnt a little bit, but not enough. And I thought, well, I'll go back and I'll drive a cab again. But previously, I'd met all these stuntmen on these other shows. And I thought, that's what I'd like to be doing. And at that time, there was a thing called the Stunt Register, had just been formed in 1973. And to get onto the stunt route, because all the stuntmen at that time used to either, they would be extras one day, and then they'd say, right, who wants to do the stairfall tomorrow? And some of the guys would put, oh, yeah, I'll do the stairfall, I'll crash the car. And it was all very much like that. And then the guys who used to do that stunt work said, we need to be a specialised body. We need to stop doing extra work, and we need to stop extras doing stunt work.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So they formed the stunt register. And to get onto the stunt register, you needed two stunt contracts. That's all you needed. And I had two stunt contracts. So I managed to get on. And it was really interesting because all of a sudden, my potential income of doing crowd work, doing extra work, finished. And these guys were well-established stuntmen and they were not going to let a young pretender in. So I was really stuck to get work. And I got the odd day here and then. I was doing work on the BBC. And then I got the job doubling pike on Dad's Army, right? So I got a little bit of work there. And I did a couple of jobs that, you know, and the word gets around and all that kind of stuff. So I started getting a bit of TV work. And then a friend of mine was working for the producer, and they were going to do The Eagle Has Landed. And they were looking for young stunties to be part of Michael Caine's group right the way through the film. So they could play the part, but then when somebody's got to fall down the stairs, fall out the building, get caught on fire, whatever, that would be us. And she managed to get me an interview with the director, John Sturges. Now, John Sturges was a hero. I mean, John Sturges directed The Magnificent Seven. I worshipped that film. I saw it 17 times. I went to the cinema 17 times to see the group. So now I'm working with a man I consider to be, seriously, God, and Michael Caine and all the other people in it, and I get the part. And kind of, it just went on from there. You know, that was the 1976, which was the year of the great summer. It just, the sun shone from April right the way through to the end of September. It was just a fantastic year. So we went to Finland and we did the Russian front stuff out there, and we had Stugs, real Stugs on the train there, just as props. And I was much more interested in the Stugs and the motorbikes than I was in. And I'm looking at them, and the boys are going, "What are you looking at?" I said, "Look, this is a real Stug," and blah 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 blah. And Michael Caine came over to me and he said, "You need professional help, don't you? Because you're more interested." And I went, "Yeah, this is great, fantastic." Anyway, we did the whole film. We had a wonderful time. I mean, just a wonderful, wonderful time in it. And I had a World War II Jeep, which I'd had for 10 years, and that was working on the film, so I was getting paid for having the Jeep on it as well. And, you know, I bought myself a brand new Harley Davidson. I thought I was, you know, king of the hill, really. Finished on that, and I thought, I'll ride out to Holland to watch the jumps on A Bridge Too Far, because my dad was there, and it's going to be the last opportunity to ever see 10 Dakotas actually chucking guys out, and there was all 10 para guys. So I got on my brand new Harley, literally with a sleeping bag and two pairs of knickers. I had no intention of doing anything else except going to watch the jumps and riding back and just, you know, putting some miles on the bike. So I get out to Holland, and I'm on the DZ watching these guys training, and I knew one of the second assistant directors out there called Roy Button, who's now head of Warner Brothers Europe. But in those days, he was a set. And he said, "Oh, yeah, you're an ex-Baptiste armourer, aren't you? Can you come and teach the Dutch guys about weapons?" He said, "Because they haven't got a clue, and they're going to be shooting up at the..." And these guys were digging the muzzles into the ground, putting blanks in to see how far they could get the stones. I mean, I thought, Jesus, if they do this with these, for real, with these guys. So I had to take all these guys to one side and do all that. And I said, "Look, Roy, you can't put me on an extras contract because I'm now on the stunt side of things. So you've got to give me a stunt contract." So I became the most expensive armourer, kind of, on the movie. And then he said, "Well, we've got a sequence next week, which is the Rhine, which is the crossing of the Rhine, Cook's Crossing with Robert Redford." Mm-hmm. He said, "You better come for that as well, because I want you with a BAR up the front, which is a tricky weapon if you don't know it." And well, I said, "All right, fine." Well, so I'm now being paid quite nicely. And a mate of mine's let me stay in his caravan out there. And I'm recycling the knickers every night because I've only got two pair. And so we did Cook's Crossing with Redford. Now, Redford was being paid $1 million for 10 days' work, $100,000 a day, right? Wow. Wouldn't get his hair cut because it was the 70s. So they had to tuck his hair up underneath. You can see it, actually, in the film. At one point, you see this all this blonde hair tucked up underneath his helmet. Wouldn't wear the boots because he said he couldn't move, you know, athletically enough. So they had to get baseball boots and paint them brown. Carried a wooden rifle and nothing in his pouches. You can see it's just paper. It's very disappointing. And he was late that morning. So we'd been sitting on the side of the Waal Canal from about, I think they called us at 3:30 in the morning to be ready because they were going to close the Waal. The Dutch authorities were closing the Waal between 8 and 9 in the morning. It's a very busy waterway. So it was a big deal on a Sunday morning. So we're to make sure that everybody's ready, we're there very early. So we're sitting on the side of the Waal from about 5:30, and it's freezing cold, and they haven't got us any brew or any food to us because there's thousands of people on this film. So finally, we get down, and he's late, and it's all going rancid. And so we get into the boats, and these little boats are supposed to be being paddled. In fact, we had some outboard motors in them and guys dressed up in uniforms, actually, just to get them across them. And so Redford is in the boat behind us, and we were all well pissed off at this point. And the special effects guy, Johnny Evans, is in our boat. And I knew John quite well. And I said, John, because he's towing explosive charges, which are all waterproofed in a kind of sausage, and towing it out. And when it gets near Redford's boat, he's going to set them off because, you know, there's like a 1,000 mil lens on the other side of the bank looking at him doing the paddling. But Hail Mary, Mother God, you've seen the film. So I said to John, get it closer. And he goes, no. I said, get it closer. Go on. No. And we're all giving it, you know. And I was, anyway, I said, now, John. He said, no. I said, yeah, now. Come back. Anyway, this thing exploded, and it was the equivalent of dropping a bathtub of water on Mr. Redford, who was drenched. I mean, absolutely. And he couldn't say anything because he knows it's a 1,000 mil camera. And he's sitting there with water dripping. And I go, hey, man. And we're all laughing our bollocks off. And the boats get taken by the current about 200 yards further down from the beach on the other side, which was now rigged with explosives. And all they told the special effects was, when the boats hit the beach, start firing the explosions. What they hadn't said, hello, brain, engage, was if they don't actually land on that beach, don't fire them. So we landed 200 yards down, and the blokes went, oh, well, they've hit the beach, so we'll fire them. So all the bangs went off, completely waste of time. So cut, no good. So we've now got to go back over to the other side, talk to the Dutch authorities to close the Vaal again, which is a real favour, whilst they reload all the explosions. And then we started a bit further upstream so that we actually landed on the beach and did it the second time. But after the first one, we were told very definitely, you do not set off the bang that close to the thing. But, you know, we got around back. So that was Bridge Too Far, which is really exciting to be at, because there were lots of ex-paras who were out there then, much younger men, obviously, 1976.
Yeah, sure.
And we got some great stories out of those guys. Great stories. It was a real privilege, too, to be there with again, Michael Caine was out there, you know. He's like, oh, you again, and all that going on. But it was interesting. And, you know, Dickie Attenborough was a delightful man, called everybody darling. Darling, would you do this, darling? Move over there and we're going to do this. And he was a real old show busy guy. But
do you know, it's a big difference then between, like, I mean, the stunts of then and, I mean, now we've got sort of, there was no CGI or anything.
No CGI.
Back then,
so no, yeah, all... no, very differently. We did everything for real. And if you like, on Bonds, we would be there rehearsing for 3 to 4 weeks to do that end sequence where there's all the explosions and people falling over and getting shot and all that kind of stuff. Now there's so much of it you can do against green screen.
Yeah, sure.
And I mean, you still have to do the gags. You know, there's, you know, Casino Royale, those guys were still up on that crane for the opening sequence, which was absolutely fantastic. But a huge amount of it was done green screen in the studio as well, which you wouldn't have had that luxury in those days. The camera guys would have had to been up either shooting it from a helicopter. No drones then. Even then, there was no drones. I don't think for Casino Royale. But when we did it, we were there weeks and weeks and weeks rehearsing, which was great fun.
I love the fact you just slipped in the Bond films. I mean, going back to, I mean, do you remember the first time you were approached for a Bond film then? I mean, surely that must have been...
Well, I did Thunderball as an armourer.
Crikey, see, that's going back to...
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's a long time ago, Sonny. And then I think the first one I performed on, I think, could have been Octopussy, or it might have been before that. I can't remember. I mean,
was that the Roger Moore day, or was that...
That was Roger Moore, Moore, and that was actually quite an unfortunate story, because I was doubling for an Indian guy whose character was called Gobinda. I can't remember the actor's name. And I was wearing a turban, and I was all, you know, nobody worried about being darkened up in those days. It wasn't the political correctness thing. And I'm hacking away with a sword at Bond on the top of this train. And we were filming it in on the Neen Valley Railway in Peterborough, which is a steam railway, because it's supposed to be in India. And Bond's double at that time was a guy called Martin Grace. Lovely Martin, an Irishman, very gentle man, great stuntman. And he was doing the stuff hanging on the side of the train and all that, and they were filming it from a helicopter. And there was supposed to be just a 2.5 mile stretch that was clear, didn't have any obstructions close to the line. And then at the end of that, we were supposed to stop and then come back to number ones. Well, we'd done it two or three times, and then the helicopter crew had just set it up right, and they'd reached the end of the 2.5 mile stretch. And they said, keep going, keep going. It looks fantastic, fantastic. And somebody just leaning outside my, keep going, keep going. And he swung out a little bit too far and he hit a steel stanchion. And they stopped the train. He managed to hang on until it stopped, but he'd smashed his hip in at least two or three places. And that was, you know, quite, I mean, that was Martin Knackered. But we were the second unit, so we didn't have quite the backup that the first unit did. So as we're carrying Martin on the stretcher into the ambulance, I'm actually taking Roger Moore's wig off Martin because it's the only one we've got. I mean, this is, you know, because I know that I'm going to be next in line to double Roger because I'm, you know, the right size. So I doubled him for the rest of the sequence, and it was quite a salient lesson in you know, what can happen when it goes wrong.
I was going to say, there must be times when you get nervous. I mean, like, do you genuinely think, oh, I can't do this? Or is there never that thought that crosses your mind when you're doing anything?
I've turned down two jobs. One was doubling Peter O'Toole on a thing called Rogue Mail up in Wales. And it was a job where there's two towers, real towers in this castle in Wales. And the idea is he fires a bow, an arrow with a sort of thin line across to his mate through the window, and then pulls it a proper rope, and then he climbs out of the window and swings down to the tower on the other side, and then climbs up the rope and gets escaped. And I said, "Well, that's fine, but you need to have the rope needs to be suspended. You need to put some scaffold up between the two, because if you try and go from this one to the, and they couldn't get it, they couldn't get the kinetics of going from one to the other like that without either having a line to slow you up, because you're going to be twisting. There's no guarantee you can put your feet on it if you could take the impact when you hit the tower." And they wouldn't spend the money. They said, no, we haven't got that kind of money. And I said, look, I'll come up there with a rigger. We'll work out how to do it. And be fine. No, we haven't got that sort of money. They wouldn't send me on a recce. They sent me a picture postcard of the town to show me the town and a little line.
Dimensions. Or
yes,
something,
with the dimensions on it. I mean, that's how crude it was. And I went, I'm sorry, guys, you're asking for trouble. So there was a Welsh stuntman up there, and they got him to do it because they were shooting him well. And he said, there was a lot of dialogue about, London stuntmen have got no bottle and all that kind of stuff. Because I know the makeup girl who was making him up, and he was giving it all large. And anyway, he did it for real. He tied the rope round himself and just launched himself. And of course, he hit the other tower like a sack of shit. And now the thing has tightened up and he's hanging there. He's completely unconscious because he'd broken four ribs and his collarbone, and he'd fractured his skull. He was unconscious. And they didn't have enough rope to lower him. They tried to get him up to the top and they couldn't get him through the window because he was completely unconscious. So they had to run down and get some more rope, run up there, tied on, so they could lower him down to the floor. Which technically, when they said he was almost not breathing when they got him. And eventually, they got him going. They got him in the ambulance and everything. But that was the end of his career. So I kind of feel, for that one, I made the right decision.
It's probably the right decision.
Yeah, but, you know, you got to know when it's not your day. This is silly. This is somebody being, you know, wistful thinking about something, and they've got no idea.
So I imagine as a director, you just want to get bigger and bigger.
Yeah,
inside,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So going back to a Bond set, because I'm going to have to ask you about, obviously, GoldenEye. It is the... were you super excited?
We're talking about tanks, aren't we, Richard?
Yeah, well, I just want to talk about this particular tank at the moment. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that sequence in GoldenEye, for those that don't remember, it was St. Petersburg, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, St. Petersburg and Leveson Studios.
Okay.
Because
you're going to spoil
originally
it
we were going to shoot... No, we were going to shoot the whole thing out there. And they had paid... Barbara Broccoli had paid this huge... amount of money to the St. Petersburg authorities to be able to film out there. And so it was all locked in place with contracts and this, that and the other. And then once it was locked into place, they then came back and said, oh, by the way, if you want to shoot down there, it's another $1.5 million. And she said, for a day? Well, for that sequence,
okay, yeah.
So she said, for $1.5 million, I can build St. Petersburg in Leveson Studios, which is what she did. So we went out there and shot the stuff that we had to shoot. It was, you know, minimal in St. Petersburg. And of course, one of the sequences to make it work was going alongside the canal there, the river. It was freezing cold. There were still small icebergs floating down the river. But they said, you can't bring a T-55 down there because it's going to go through, you've got to have something lighter. So they built two T-55s based on Saladin chassis.
Okay.
But they had, you know, moving tracks and the whole, I mean, the whole thing was built to scale. I mean, it was an enormous project to do that for two shots. And we had two of them in case one broke down. So I'm actually effectively driving the Saladin, and you turn the motor on to get the tracks to go round, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then I'm chasing these Jeeps, which are now reversing, firing AKs at us, and we got bullet hits all over it and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't fun at all, I promise you. And then we revert to, you know, the proper T-55 on the other bank, and we had all these English stuntmen and Russian stuntmen, and it was an extraordinary experience. I mean, extraordinary experience. And every time we drove the T-55 anywhere, if there were any civilian cars parked there, all these burglar alarms would go off. And anyway, the net was that on one of the Sundays that we were shooting there, the authorities said, no, you can't go on any further. We want some more money. So the producer went to the mayor's house. This is on Sunday morning. We'd been there at 7 o'clock. And so he's gone to the mayor's house with an interpreter, knocked on the door, and the mayor's come out in his dressing gown. And he said, let me tell you, the power of the Bond movie means that I can have this on the front page of every paper globally tomorrow to say that you've held us to ransom. Here's $10,000 in cash. Go inside and make the phone call, and we expect it. And sure enough, half an hour later, we continued shooting. So that was an interesting idea on the dynamic of filming.
How do you get it to slide? Having driven, obviously, a lot of tanks in my lifetime, because tanks just don't slide like that. Was there some secret to it? You see sequences of it coming around corners, it's almost like broadsiding it at some points.
If I told you that.
Is it a secret? Is it? It's
like, no, yeah. I'll tell you how we did it. So they said you have to run the tank on rubber track pads.
Yeah.
There is no rubber track pads.
A lot of cobbled streets in it, St. Petersburg, and it's got a lot of cobbled streets.
Yeah,
as well,
a lot of cobbled streets, but just they just said, we can't, you know, afford you. It's a very heavy tourist area. You need to have rubber tracks. So I sat down with the special effects coordinator, and we worked out, we got a couple of links of Chieftain track, and we worked out the pitch of that, and we found that the Chieftain track, the horns are too wide. But if we cut the horns off on the inside track so they didn't actually rub against the bodywork, and we got some sprockets made up with the right gaps for that Chieftain track would work, and that's what we did. So we got machined sprockets made up for
so
the
you
rear
cut the horns off each
yeah
cuts off.
I spent the whole day with a gas axe cutting the inside horns off so that it would clear, and then we put the tracks on. Now we've got brand new track pad rubbers, which are too grippy. So now I take each of the tanks out every day, and I'm slow. Because the T-55 has got a two-speed rear axle, you bang the left side of the diff in, and it will, that's what'll make it turn very sharply. So I was out there doing endless turns to get the rubber down to a level where it was still rubber, but there was less rubber on the road and bits. It was a real fine point. And then we started experimenting with buckets of half fairy liquid and half water or diesel, or, and I can't remember now what the mix is that worked.
Secret magic
but
mix.
Eventually, but you'd have been hard pushed if you hadn't had that two-speed rear axle on that. You'd have been hard pushed to do it with some tanks that didn't work like that. But with the T-55, it was perfect. Bang, that left or right track stopped, and it would start to drift. And so, you know, and then you had to start, you know, learning how to dance with it, because it was, obviously, it's a big old lump if it gets, you know, tied up in knots. And so we would, you know, put the cameras back, and then as we got the hang of each one, then the cameras would start to creep forward a bit, so we could get the dynamism of a wide-angle lens on it rather than shooting it safely on a long lens. But again, that's what Bond was all about. They just said, tell us what you need, and we'll get it for you. Now it's all like, oh no, you've got to indent that. You want a couple of screwdrivers. Put the purchase order in and all that.
Oh,
and
really?
It is literally like, yeah, they just said, get whatever you need to.
Because they were always synonymous, weren't they? I always remember, I mean, my father was a huge, it was like a family treat, was the new Bond film. You go as a family to the cinema, and it was the biggest and best and most, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stunts were incredible.
Yeah.
So of all those vehicles you've driven then, or been part of, was that, do you think, one of the favourite that you ever got your hands on, or?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I enjoyed that more than any other Bond film. But Pierce is an old mate of mine.
I knew
him a drama school. You know, I mean, I knew him when he was absolutely nothing and nobody. And we used to hang around together and yada yada. So when he came to do Goldeneye, which is his first Bond, there's a sequence where in the opening sequence you see a mate of mine, Wayne Michaels, does the dive off the dam. Do you remember that? I mean, it's spectacular,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then you see him come through the ceiling of this Russian, and there's a Russian bloke sitting on the Kazi with his trousers around his ankles reading a paper. And Pierce went, I know who's going to be sitting on the Kazi. Well, thank you very much, just to get his own back. So that was the start of it. And then we just had a lot of fun. You know, there was a lot of... Gary, who was the principal driver of the tank, you know, I taught him how to drive the tank, and then, you know, we drove it together, and you know, he was fantastic. I mean, absolutely fantastic. You know, Pierce was just having fun. He'd been doing that Remington Steel show in America for
years.
Of course,
yeah.
And they'd wanted him to do the previous Bond, but MTM, which is Mary Tyler Moore's production company, who were doing Remington Steel, wouldn't let him out of his contract. Otherwise, he would have done the previous one.
Right.
So they did another one with Roger, and then they retired Roger, and Pierce came on board, and it was just a giggle. And Martin, the director, I'd known since he was a young art director, so I'd known him for years, and so there was a relationship there. And the second unit was great. We had such fun. Ian Sharp, who was the second unit director, I'd done The Professionals with him and Sweeney's and all that kind of stuff.
Bodie and Doyle, wasn't that the Professionals?
Yes, Bodie and Doyle. Let's not, so there were lots of mates, you know, and Harvey Harrison, who was one of the cameramen I'd known for donkey's years, so, and the special effects guys were all. So we had a good time. We had a good time at that, but it was quite, you know, it was hairy. It was hairy at times, you know, because you've 55 tons not 55 tons, sorry, a T-55 is a big chunk of steel.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're giving it rock all. And we had three of them. So at one point I had Eddie Kidd, who'd now, you know, Eddie Kidd, the motorcycle jumper.
Yeah,
yeah, he was working as a stuntman on the show. And Eddie was just a wonderful character, but he would never stop rabbiting, particularly if it was girls. It was just all over him like a cheap sponge, you know. And I had one sequence where I'm now directing the second, helping the, you know, as a second unit stunt coordinator, and Gary's driving the tank. And there's a sequence where there's a huge, great Perrier truck full of Perrier water, which Perrier had given us, you know, the whole lot, thousands. We all drank Perrier for months and months afterwards. And the tank drives right the way through it. But as it's coming down the street and he's getting up to speed, I wanted a car to pass in front, and that was Eddie. But he was behind a building, so he couldn't see the tank. And I said, Eddie, watch me, and I'll give you the cue. When I drop my hand, you go across in front of the tank. And Eddie was, yeah, fine, mate. And he's talking to somebody here. And he missed the cue, and I go, Eddie, don't go. And he thought I was giving him the cue. And the tank missed him by inches because he wasn't, you know, he was giving it too much of that and not enough. Yeah, anyway, there were all sorts of things like that happened. And at one point, one of the boys stalled when we were in Russia, just going in front of the tank. And Gary was driving, and I was, you know, directing with Ian Sharp. I was coordinating that sequence. And Gary's pulled and you don't stop that tank easily. And he's come up right up to it here, and there's no room to go left and right because there are other cars here. And he literally came out and just nudged it and rolled into the wheel. It's like, oh, thank you, Lord. I mean, but we were doing it for real. Now you'd CG that crossing car. You know, you put it in post-production and no risk and everything else. But then it was proper job.
So, Jim, on the subject of historical accuracy, now, there's one thing in movies that really gets my goat. It's when you can see stuff that, A, wasn't even there in that period, or it's the wrong thing being used, or in relation to vehicles, you've got these sort of like hybrid vehicles, which clearly are not the right vehicle. How do you feel about that sort of thing?
Look, it's very easy to criticise things, and you look at things like the Battle of the Bulge and Patton, where it's all M48 tanks done up with a cross on it, whether they're American or German and all that kind of stuff. And for 90% of the people who are looking at it, they wouldn't know the difference anyway. But I feel that with the advent of CGI and the fact that there are a lot more collectors now who've restored and who drive original vehicles, there's almost no excuse for getting it wrong, because you look on the internet, in the old days, again, your reference was a lot of books, and you had to plow through miles and miles of pages of books to get, unless you knew and you'd studied it, like some of us had, you know. And it used to drive me mad on films, just the basic things like Germans carrying an MP40, and they'd have rifle ammunition pouches because the costume department said, well, those are what they wore in the picture. And I said, yeah, that's what they wear in the picture when they've got a Mauser 98K. But these are, oh, we don't have those. Oh, well, okay, fine. So it was, the inaccuracies were criminal as far as I was concerned. But then eventually, it was interesting working on Private Ryan, because I went in when the film started. I went into the production office and looked around at some of the drawing, and I thought, oh, my goodness me, they've actually got some people who know what they're doing. And so we had people like webbing wranglers for German webbing. And
a webbing wrangler.
A webbing wrangler.
Okay.
Okay. The uniform guys knew what they were talking about. They really did. And they were triple sharp. And if anybody was trying to put something in there that was the wrong... I mean, those combat vests that the Rangers wore. We got hold of an original one. We had some made up exactly to that specification. I think in Italy, funnily enough. And then put them on a piece of rope and dragged them around the field behind a Jeep for an hour or so to get them looking battered and worn in those sort of places. They had in the airborne jackets, there's a little pocket here up on the top here, which contains a little knife, so that if you get hung up in a tree and you can't actually reach your boot knife, you've got a little thing here that you could cut away your rigging lines. Now, who would know that? But they put the pocket in. And they found some of the original knives, and they put them in just so that the actors could feel that they had everything that would have been happening. And when you go to that sort of detail, it's so exciting to work on things like that, where they're finally doing it right. The uniforms are pretty much there, and the vehicles, you know, are pretty much there, with the exception of the Tiger, which I know that Spielberg, when he first saw the dummy Tigers, was disappointed. He said, oh, I thought the Tiger was as big as a house, and, you know, everybody, because of this mystique, the Tiger writers.
Yeah, no, of course, yeah.
And although they were only the ones that, because they were built on the T-34 chassis, were about 2.5 feet shorter, but it was pretty much the same dimensions otherwise. That was the only thing that kind of, every time I look at that in a film, I think, ugh. Somebody should have done more to have actually put, you know, outer road wheels on it and made it a little bit, because it was so, so very much T-34 when you looked at it.
And it was really that final scene, isn't it, where he's on the bridge as well and it's coming towards him and
and all that. But when he blows the track off,
the sticky bomb and
the sticky bomb on the track, and he blows the track off, and you can see these great big flappy, you know, Russian track pads going flop, 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 and they're like, oh, matron. Which was, you know, seriously disappointing. And I was driving the tank at that point, because then Tom Hanks comes up and he fires a Tommy gun through the vision slit. And give him his due, he was very concerned about, you know, the fact that I was going to be in there. And I said, don't worry, Tom, I've got wax, and I've got, because I couldn't be seen, obviously, in there, so I didn't have to wear the uniform. I said, and don't worry, I'll be down on the floor when that thing comes through. But it's still, the noise was incredible, firing a 45 caliber Thompson, you know, about 4 feet from your ear. And that's why I've got two hearing aids and, you know, things like that, because I was also driving the half track, which blows up when we first meet Private Ryan.
I was driving the
251 copy half track. Was actually an OT810 for those people who are into all that. It's a Czech copy of it. And when the special effects guy says to you, there's going to be a bit of a bang, because normally they go, no, it's nothing, and this massive explosion. You said it was nothing. No, that was nothing. Wait. And then when they say to you, it's going to be a bit of a bang, you think, hello. So I've wedged as much wax as I can get into my ears. Then I've put on a pair of you know, ear defenders and everything, because, again, I'm in the half track, can't be seen. Even then, the wardrobe guys insisted I wore the SS uniform right down to the boots. He said, just in case. And that's the detail, you know, that's about detail. But in this case, I wore everything. But when that bang went off, I mean, I liken it to being inside a dustbin and four guys hit the outside of it with baseball bats. I mean, it was an incredible noise. I was like, blah, blah, blah. And it had to, after the explosion went off, I had to drive about another 30 feet and then slow down and stop. So and my ears are ringing and everything. Anyway, that was quite an interesting experience. But Beautifully done. And all the stunt guys were told, when you get hit, imagine you're a puppet and that somebody's just cut the strings. We don't want any of that Hollywood rubbish with and all arms flailing out. That's not what happens. So when they go, you just see them flop and drop.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly comes across in the movie, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and fantastic. Absolutely. And having worked previously with Spielberg on Indiana Jones films, 15 years beforehand, and everything was very much, they used to put a board up in the morning and they said, we're doing this shot, because he'd done an animatic back in the States and he'd virtually edited the whole film and we were just shooting it for real. And then on Private Ryan, there were like three, sometimes four units, and he'd come in the morning and say, right, we're one up there. So there was a much more flexibility to take in to account of what was happening on the set and where things were and all that kind of stuff. And it was just fascinating. And I drove another tank on that, which comes over the brow of a hill, and one of the boys hits it up the arse with a bazooka, and then it explodes again, you know. And I thought, I'm getting typecast here. Because I drove, the last one I drove was the self-propelled gun, the Marder, which has got the open fighting compartment at the back. And the guy, and they throw the Molotov cocktails into it, and the crew are all, are on fire and rolling over the sides and all that. And I'm driving it, and I'm looking. I sat in it to start with, and I could see daylight through the hatches. So I thought, if somebody gets it wrong, I'm going to get burning petrol coming through here onto me. So I wear my fire suit. So I wore my fire suit, and I had a little small fire extinguisher in there with me as well. And sure enough, it all happens, bang, and there's fuel pouring right into my lap, right into the family allowance. And so again, Simon, the second unit director, wanted me to keep driving. So I'm now spraying my crotch with CO2 to put the fire out, wriggling uncomfortably like hell to get to the end of, and kind of going, because I can't open the hatch until we hear cut, you know. And I thought, yeah, okay, crotch on fire. This is something to tell your grandchildren about, isn't it? But it was a privilege to work on that show because, we're really doing something that...
And all these things, they're obviously incredibly orchestrated for safety in that, I'd imagine. But, I mean, the sheer cost of putting it all together. What if... I mean, there must be times when you're doing something and it goes wrong. It goes tits up for whatever reason and you have to do it all over again. Is it like... Must be huge expense involved, hassle and aggro.
It is huge expense.
So in your mindset, it's I've got to get it right the first time.
Yes, I mean everybody, but they always allow on a picture like that. They allow for take two or take three. If get it on the first one, hurrah! But otherwise, they're going to go back and do it again because they've got the money to for everybody to stand around scratching their butts until they reload everything and do it again. Where. On The Pianist, which is a film I did in Germany at Babelsberg with Roman Polanski, which was a true story about the Warsaw Ghetto, and I'd rehearsed with the first day on the film was one of the major battle scenes. I mean, talk about going into it heads up, and I'd rehearsed some of the stuff the previous day, but we'd run out of light. And I hadn't been able to rehearse everything the stuntmen I got. And it was all going on in one take because it's supposed to be Spielman's point of view. So you couldn't cut cameras. And the one thing we didn't have on the rehearsal day was the tank. And I said in the morning that we started to film, I said to Roman, look, Roman, I need to rehearse the tank so he can see what's happening because he's just looking through a letterbox. And Roman got quite upset and said, I want to shoot. And I said, well... That's fine, but if we do this and it doesn't work, A, I'm not prepared to, have him run over anybody, and B, it's going to take 2 or 3 hours to reload all the special effects and everything else. And can you just give me 45 minutes? He got, have you 45 minutes? It was very offhand. Anyway, I knew the tank driver because I'd been out there doing Enemy at the Gates the year before, and he was a really nice switched on guy who spoke English. And so I ran him through it and I said, there's two guys running in front of you. When the second guy runs, then you can go. If you don't see that second guy, don't go because he may have fallen under the tracks. Anyway, we did that and 45 minutes later, come back and I said to Roman, we can go now. Thank you, sir. And he was very kind of, now you're ready for me and all this stuff. So, okay. So we did it anyway. We did it and it worked. Thank God. Thank you, Lord. it worked, and we got it, you know, in one take of that master take. And he came up afterwards and said, "Thank you. I realised that now you tell me about tanks and guns and what we can do here, and I'll do my thing." And it was a fantastic relationship, and it was an extraordinary thing. But principally, it was because they hadn't paid for that tank to be there for that rehearsal day. If they had done that, then we could have started at 7:30 that morning, as soon as it was light, and done the shot, you know.
And I suppose we'll have to talk a little bit briefly about Fury. So it was sort of not that long ago now. In fact, it was going on
five years ago.
I mean, that for me, I have to say, I mean, because as you said before, there's always critics who will knock every single film. But for me, the accuracy of that, I mean, using Tiger 131 from Bovington, using the Sherman, one of the Shermans was from Bovington as well.
Yeah.
I mean, for that to work on, it must have been an absolute joy,
I
imagine.
It was really interesting, really exciting. We had some lovely light dragoons who came to man the tanks and be TCs as well, who'd been out in Afghan.
Well, the RTR weren't available, or
well, the you know, RTR, I mean, they've got too much money and they didn't need to work. You know, they're a very rich regiment, but the light dragoons guys were absolutely, and I was a bit sceptical because they weren't film orientated. They'd never been on a film set in their lives before, but their command and structure of actually doing, you know, what needed to be done with the tank, and the tank drivers were owner drivers. So again, they were not inducted into the military system so much, but when these guys began to talk to them in the right language, everything came into place. So we had light dragoon tank commanders, except for one actor in the thing, and then Brad's crew, who, again, I took them for days on driving around, and I made them switch positions, and everybody knew what they were doing. And I've got a little bit of film of them rehearsing on the first day, just how to get into the tank, just for Brad to become familiar with how he got up the front of the tank.
And so he looked like he'd done it a few hundred times before.
And I did it again and again and again and again, and I was tired of putting the watch on. And, you know, okay, you're 24 seconds. Come on, guys, I need you in there ready to go in 12 and a half, 13 seconds max. And we worked and we worked and we worked like that. And that was great, you know, because they had they took them as well. They had a kind of preschool where they took them out and they made them bivvy at night and and eat rat packs and all that kind of stuff and toughen them up, and one or two of them really, really, really got into it big time. And one of them actually didn't wash for the entire film. He said, "Well, this is how they would have lived." And eventually, you know, he got this huge boil came up in his back, and the doctor said, "Look, you know, you haven't been acclimatizing yourself for a year like these guys have. You know, you're doing it. You know, you need to have a shower." That was interesting. But they lived in the tank a lot of the day. They would have their meals in the tank, and they would pee into a box and all that kind of stuff, and they would stay in the tank together. And at lunchtime, when we broke for lunch, you just see, because Brad liked to have a cigarette and one of the other guys was a smoker, and you'd see smoke just filtering out through. Then you knew that the boys were in there chatting or making phone calls or whatever it was. It was bizarre in a way. But it was kind of hard work because we had three different engine configurations there. You know, we had radials and we had diesel and we had petrol and a multibank engine, the only multibank engine that I've ever seen running. And this guy had rebuilt it. I mean, you have no idea the complexity of a multibank engine until you see one or photographs of one in pieces. I mean, it's unbelievable. And Adrian, the guy who owned the tank, had done this, and it just ran like a Swiss watch. That was the tank. If you ever wanted to do close-ups of tanks turning, we got Adrian's tank and we ran that. Whereas the twin diesels on Fury, one of them was very tired and she started smoking quite seriously. And the last day on the film, it was like a smoke screen coming down the road. And I mean, the whole thing packed up. I mean, she just held out till the last day of shooting. But it was a great experience. And David Ayer, the director who wrote the script, actually put together a whole series of scenarios which he'd read in a book called Death Traps, which was written by a guy who was in charge of tank repair from Normandy to the end of the war in the Second Armoured. And he would drive up in a Jeep at night and say, "Right, we can rob parts off that one to make this one work," and they'd pull them back. And there were various incidents that he talks about in the book. And David Ayer had put some of those together to make part of the story for Fury, but that's what he'd based it on. And they were all proper events that actually happened. And so when you saw the sequence with the guy gets hit with a Panzerfaust with a Hitler Youth kid, mm-hmm. blows that up, when you see him coming out of the turret on fire and he rolls off the back deck, that was based on a little piece of film that you can see on YouTube of this Panther tank that they engaged in just outside Cologne Cathedral in the last days of the war. And you see a guy in a Sherman that's hit by the Panther, and he rolls out of the top of the turret with his leg missing, left leg missing from the knee down, but he's also on fire, and you see him roll over the back deck and off onto the ground before a M or a Jackson or something came in and engaged the Panther. But it's all there on 8mm film. You can see it on YouTube. It's a fascinating little section of film. But again, that was based on that. So he put all these little vignettes into the film that actually happened. So that was a really good experience, again, because he was well into it. David Ayo is a collector and a World War II buff, as is his producer. And between the two of them, they said, we're going to get this right. And I think most of the time, we did get it right.
Yeah, and it certainly came across in that particular movie as well. Now, you sort of said there's history buff and that. You've obviously got a genuine love and passion for history as well, the military service. I believe you've owned a few vehicles yourself in your lifetime as well.
Yes, and I still drive them. I have a German BMW R75 motorcycle outfit, which I first rode on the Dirty Dozen and fell in love with. I said, I've got to have one of these motorcycles. And I actually finished up buying that particular one that I rode on the Dirty Dozen after A Bridge Too Far, because it belonged to that armory company that I used to work for. And I kept on saying to them, please sell me that bike. But eventually he said, oh, for God's sake, get off my back. And he sold the bike to me. And that was in 1976. I've ridden thousands of miles all over Europe. I've rebuilt it in a minute. And I absolutely love that bike. But I've got a military 45 Harley Davidson, which I bought in 1970, which Brad Pitt was desperate to buy off me in Fury. And I said, even you don't have enough money.
So you show me, we were having a coffee, and you show me a photo of Brad Pitt riding this bike.
He was riding my R75.
Really upset next to him, yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, are you okay? Because you're clunking the gears a bit and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, I found him another Harley Davidson with the same patina that mine, because I've done 60,000 miles of mine, and it's got patina. And that's what he liked about it. He didn't want a sort of, squeaky new floor type bike. And I found him another one towards the end of the film. And then I'd been using my Jeep on the film as a runabout, really, because you could park it in shot and it was not going to, because it's a proper job. And then the clutch went one day on my birthday. So I didn't have a runabout, so I went and got my R75 and used that as a runabout while I waited for the parts and we fit a new clutch, etc. And then he said, oh, that's nice, because we didn't have one on the film at that point that ran. We had some dead ones. And so then I said, I suppose you want one of these, do you? And he said, yeah, I do. So I managed to get one of those for him, built in Germany, but all Malto Immaculato and everything thing, But yes, and I've had a duck. I had a duck for 25 years, proper military duck, which crossed the channel in that for the 50th anniversary of D-Day with about 9 other ducks. It took us 7.5 hours. And we've ridden that up the Rhine and up the Seine and all those places. Had great fun with that, but I'm a little bit too old to climb in and out of that now. But I had, great. And I had an Achilles Sherman for a while. And I've had a track Jeep and, various. I've got still got a Kettencrad, a track motorcycle, German track motorcycle.
And
some other motorcycles, again, military. So, yes, I saw a long way of saying yes.
I was asked to ask you this question. So, souvenirs, from all this multitude of movies, do you ever steal anything? You're not allowed to say. Do you ever take souvenirs?
Souvenirs I've got... No. I have got Donald Sutherland's dog tags from The Dirty Dozen.
Yeah.
His character's name in that was Vernon Pinkley. And I've got those dog tags. I've got... that guy who was in Dallas, who was in The Eagle Has Landed, JR, I can't remember the actor's name.
Oh, crikey. I know exactly who
you know
who
he is. Anyway. I've got his fiberglass M1 carbine that he carried in that, and a few bits and pieces from Indiana Jones. In fact, I had an Indiana Jones stunt hat because I was one of the villains in the boat chase that we did on that, and Harrison's hat kept on blowing off, the stunt ones that he got, and we pick it up out of the water and then we go, and eventually when we finished it, they had 5 or 6 of them, and eventually on the last day I picked it out of the water, and then Spielberg said, what, this hat's causing us a problem, let's say he doesn't do the fight with the hat on and it appears later and we don't ask the question about it. So I put this hat back in the boat and then we carried on, forgotten all about it, and then when we finished on the film, the wardrobe truck had gone and I was getting my pads out from the boat and there was the hat and I thought, oh, I'll put it on. So I, yeah, I inherited that one. But there's, I wish I didn't, a lot more, because I didn't realise there's all these film nuts out there. Some seriously.
Well, we were having dinner together last night, and one of our crew, I mean, we've not even mentioned it, we're sort of running out of time, but obviously with Star Wars nuts, I mean, you have met some passionate, I imagine, fans of Star Wars. Just very briefly, tell us what your part in Star Wars was.
I was a stunt stormtrooper in the original Star Wars, running around with these sets that wobbled and you know, in this incredibly uncomfortable and hot plastic outfit, and you couldn't sit down because if you did, something went up your bum, and so you had to stand most of the day, take the helmet off, and then you, to stop the helmet, every time you nodded your head, you are looking at the floor, so you had to put more foam rubber into it to keep it tight on your head, and of course you sweated more, and I mean it was just a very uncomfortable exercise, and thought, what a load of rubbish this is going to be, you know. Well, seriously, we thought this is going to be worse than Doctor Who, seriously. And Harrison thought his career was finished. Really, nobody had any idea until we went to the crew showing and we actually saw the completed item, and then it was just like, oh my goodness me, this is really something outstanding.
And you were telling me that you've been to a convention or two about it, you've been invited.
The first time, about 8 years ago, 10 years ago, somebody rang me up out of the blue and said, would you come and sign autographs? And I said, no, I'm not an actor, I'm a stuntman, we don't do that. He said, no, we'd really like you to come to this Star Wars convention at Olympia. And I thought, I said, are you going to pay me? He said, yeah. All right. And I've got a flat just around the corner from Olympia. It's 2 minutes walk. Fine. So I turn up, not knowing what to expect. And there's all these guys that I knew from the film, you know, little Kenny Baker and you know, various people, and Jeremy Bullock, and people I haven't seen for a long time. So they're all chatting, and I don't know what we're in for. And they put me behind this table, and there's a whole load of photographs of stormtroopers and another character that I played in The Empire Strikes Back, where I'm actually something called a Bespin guard. Don't ask me, but a lot of people know all about Bespin guards, right? So the first guy comes to the table, and a great big, you know, never miss a lunch bunch guy, and he rolls this film poster out, and it's got lots of photo, you know, lots of signatures on it, Dave Prowse and various people on it, and he said, "I need you to sign down here," and I said, "And this is a funny accent," and I said, "Where have you come from, mate?" And he said, "Ah, Sydney, Australia." I said, "For one day?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I wouldn't miss this one. You've flown from Sydney to get a few autographs?" I mean, these people do need professional help. So I've signed the autograph, and then they've taken a tenner off him per signature. I mean, now I'm beginning to get how this works.
From, yeah.
Right? So the next guy, I say, "Where have you come from?" "Austin, Texas." I said, "Yeah, sure." And there was this catalogue of strange people who were Star Wars fans who travel wherever is necessary to get a few signatures. And since then, I've been to Japan, paid for to sign things. And you go there, and they like to dress up in the costume. But you've got people dressed as Wookiees who are a foot shorter than I am, right? And they come along, and then you've got Darth Vader, and now you can buy a Darth Vader helmet, which distorts your voice and makes what you're saying sound like Darth Vader. I mean, it's just whatever. Well, you know, whatever gets you.
So, unfortunately, Jim, we're starting to run out of time. So what's the future hold for you? What's the big life
plan? I'm of an age. What is the future hold? Well, I'm of an age. I'm still working, luckily.
Yeah.
And
I was going to say, I tried to get hold of you a few weeks ago and you were in Kazakhstan.
I was in Kazakhstan doing a commercial for the new Land Rover Defender, which is out now, so I'm allowed to talk about it, which was fascinating. Ninth biggest country in the world and only 5 million people there, you know, driving for hours and not seeing another car in this extraordinary environment. That was good fun. I was working on one of those superhero films the other day, driving a Bentley, and 2 weeks ago I was driving a Rolls Royce 4x4 for an Ed Sheeran video. I'd never heard of Ed Sheeran. Isn't that a terrible thing? He's a very nice man, very, very nice man. I liked him enormously. And ragging this 4x4 around a field, spinning it and doing all that, $300,000 worth of Rolls Royce, right? And the weird thing was that suddenly this slightly strange voice comes out from the radio saying, "If you do that again, I'm going to switch the car off." And the guy from the dealership was watching for on the video inside. I don't know how this worked. And the guy's going, "Don't do that again. You're messing the car up." And he could have switched the car off from where we were in the middle of this field in Hertfordshire somewhere. It was extraordinary. So, yeah, and I'm still doing, I do EastEnders a bit and occasionally Casualty and shows like that. As long as the phone goes, I love it. I do love it. Richard. I do love it.
So no plans for retirement then? You can't see that on
the... I don't mention the R word. We don't do that, no. No, because there's so much going on out there. And, I'm involved with the Wheel Foundation and you know, we've got the Yag Panther that was at Tankfest this year, and we've got some extraordinary projects. We're restoring 3 German armoured cars, 2 four-wheeled and 1 six-wheeled armoured cars. And in 3 to 4 years, hopefully, we'll have those 3 up and running, restored to a level the same as the JP.
Mm-hmm.
Everything works, the correct optics, the guns. We want to get the KWK firing, which we've already done on that, the 20mm KWK. And that's the sort of level of restoration that we do in the Wheel Foundation. We're a live museum. Everything that we have there works. 250s, 251s, Schwimmbahn, Kuhwagen, Kettenkrads, you know, 1-ton half tracks. Everything runs. We've got 2 Stugs. We've got 1 Stug that came out from under the Black Sea and was retrieved in the 90s, completely restored by Mike Gibbs guys, right down to the fact that he found 2 members of the German unit that the Stugs were on the way to when they were sunk in the Black Sea. He found a member of the Russian submarine that torpedoed it and a member of the German ship, and put all that together. So it's not just about the vehicles, it's about the history. Mm. And that's what fascinates me, is the history. We restored a Type 23 Horsch staff car, which appeared at first glance to have actually been issued to Rommel in the desert. Beautiful restoration. I mean, cost God knows what. Long story about that one, but we haven't got time to go into that. But we found Rommel's driver, Hermann von Leipzig, still alive, living in Namibia, who speaks perfect English. And we flew him over for the launching of the vehicle in Germany when the restoration was finished. Mr. von Leipzig came in, and then he was in his 80s then. This is about 12 years ago. And he came in and we pulled the curtains back and he looked at the car and it was quite interesting. And then he sat in the car and then the tears started to come down and he started to tell us exactly, A, how he'd switched, moved things around on the dashboard when he'd been driving the car to make things easier ergonomically at night so that he could reach things. And then he told us how at night Rommel would get him to drive about a kilometre away from his headquarters and he would sleep on the back seat so he could just be away from the brain damage. And Mr. von Leipzig would put a little bivvy up, 50 yards away, and he'd cook him some supper. And he told us all about the relationship. That stuff is priceless. I mean, Mr. von Leipzig's dead now. Absolutely, those are the things, the stories that come with these vehicles that I find so fascinating.
And talking of stories, I mean, we're really, really pushed for time now, but there is a book on the way, I do believe.
Yes, a mate of mine persuaded me and said, you need to do your memoirs. So, and I do mean reluctantly, because, a lot of memoirs come out just as an I fest. I did this, I, me, mine. And, there's so many things in this industry which have been fascinating and I've been privileged to share with lots of people. So I hope it's not. Anyway, it's called Full Burn. It'll be out at Christmas time. I've got, lots of pictures, of silly pictures of things I got up to in the past and talking about all the rubbish we've been talking about today. So, yes, hopefully, go and buy one. It's a very good Christmas present.
Absolutely, go and buy one. Jim, thank you so much. I mean, it's an absolute pleasure. I have to genuinely say, one of the most humble people I've ever met. Certainly up there with one of the most interesting I've ever met in my life. I feel like I could talk to you forever. And thank you so much for being who you are. And
my pleasure.
I can't wait for the book.
And proper Earl Grey tea, I might say.
And proper Earl Grey tea.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and follow us on social media for the next episode of Tank Nuts.